Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended, with 16 locations including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com.
It's Current State for Tuesday on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up on today's show, there are already new exhibits to begin at East Lansing's Broad Art Museum. I feel sorry for the people who are about to miss the exhibits that are ending to make room for the new ones. Consider that encouragement to visit the Broad between now and the end of this week. You've got to see Red Project. It's great. Anyway, the Broad's Michael Rush joins us in a little bit to talk about what's new and how the first few months have gone. Professor Robert Glennon is sounding an alarm on the state of Michigan's groundwater. We'll hear from him in a few minutes. And the Izzone on the day of the Indiana game. Kevin Lavery reports on that later this hour. But first, in 5 weeks, Michigan's new right-to-work law takes effect. Some number of local Michigan teacher unions are working to lock in new contracts before then. It's apparently an effort to delay the impact of the controversial new law, since it will not affect a contract already in place when it kicks in on March 27th. Right to work legally allows employees not to pay union dues. And here to explain what's going on, the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta, who's hard at work on a story about this. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Mark.
And we've also got Guillermo Lopez, who's head of the president of the Lansing School Board, as apparently some of this activity is going on in Lansing, too. Good morning, Guillermo.
Good morning, Mark.
One thing we should start out saying is that it's not just union dues, that, you know, that we don't have closed shops per se where everyone has to join the union.
Okay.
It's just if you opt out of joining the union, you still have to pay what's called an agency fee,
right,
which is essentially a fee paid to the union for bargaining your contract, but you don't get any of the other benefits that
any of the other goodies.
Yeah.
Okay. Rick, we'll start with you. Is it known how many districts teachers' unions in Michigan are right now pursuing new contracts by March 27th?
No, but there's, you know, something north of 1,000 union locals, and so we can expect that a lot of them are trying to get these. They're being called different things. I've heard the term a parallel labor agreement or a parallel contract, where they just go in to the agency fee part of the deal, and you know, requiring people to, you know, remain attached to the union in that way, and extending that out for 3, 4, 5, 6, even, you know, 10 years in some cases.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're and it's not just schools; it's also universities. Michigan State University could be involved in that process. Lansing Community College, but it's places where these public employee unions have agreements, and they're trying to create an extension of that aspect of it that allows. That allows them to maintain that required relationship,
okay,
with the union. And of course, you know, school districts, if they're, some are saying just no, they don't think that they can do that. I think that happened in the case of let me look at my collection materials here, but I think in Oakland County there's at least one school district that's just said no, we don't think we can. Mm-hmm. And where it is happening, school districts are negotiating concessions. You know, if you look in the case of Lansing, there's an $11 million budget deficit here. And I think your other guest could probably answer this, that the school board would be asking for some help in that direction and maybe some others if they're going to agree to this contract extension.
But whatever, the bottom line is this, whatever's in place on March 27th effectively delays right to work for the duration of,
right,
that agreement.
That a state law cannot abrogate a contract. So any contracts that are in place on March 27th, when the law takes effect, remain the remain effective, you know, absent some other legal maneuver that would get around that. But.
And Guillermo Lopez, why don't you jump in here? How is this all unfolding here in Lansing?
Well, you know, our school board and the union reps have been talking about the contract, you know, renewal. But that was even before all this came about, because the contract expires June 30th. So we had been in talks, and not in talks necessarily, but talking about it. We recently met as a board with our administration, reviewed the things we needed to have in terms of the needs of the school district, and asked our administration to go forth with negotiations, and in good faith, hopefully that the result will be let's call it a win-win for both.
Well, did the passage of right to work add some urgency to this situation, though?
Well, obviously, yes, it did. On the other hand, you know, we wanted to have our contract done prior to June 30th, regardless, because it only helps us to plan better for the school year.
How many members are there in the this is the LSEA, the Lansing Schools Education Association? How many members?
Oh, I think they have around 1,000 members.
Okay, and the current
give or take, I'm not sure.
And the current contract runs until. June 30th.
Yeah. And we should point out that it's not just, you can't just have negotiated a deal by March 27th. That means that the contract, whatever, you know, at least that part of it, needs to be negotiated. It needs to have been submitted to the membership and voted on and ratified by the members and ratified by the school board, you know, and signed and done. So it's not just a matter of agreeing on things. There's also a process that needs to take place after that.
This is also interesting, though, because I would assume teachers want the contract extended as far into the future as possible to delay the impact. But that means calculating salaries, benefits, looking at work rules, the whole thing farther into the future. Rick Plute is shaking his head no.
No, because what would happen if there's a parallel contract on that aspect of it? You could do the normal. Guillermo, I think that a contract is typically 2 years. Is that correct?
Two or three years.
So you could do a standard two-year contract, but then take that one aspect of it that deals with the agency fees and extend that out for a decade or so. I mean, at least that's the theory. And that, no doubt, if and when that happens, that will be tested in court, because there are groups already trying to line up clients to challenge these long-term agreements if they happen.
Uh-huh.
Superintendent Yvonne Kamal Kanul of Lansing told me yesterday that a longer-term contract is going to require concessions. Is that topic's got to be on the table, I assume, Guillermo?
Well, you know, we met with administration, with Superintendent Kamal Kanul, and we laid out the needs of the district. And obviously, you know, we would have to have concessions regardless, okay, because the budget just cannot, you know, afford all the things that we want to do or that we want to have. So we have to have concessions regardless.
Rick, are you
at this point in time, you know, it makes it a little more important.
Rick Pluta, are you finding that administrations are at times sympathetic to the plight of the teachers' union and are more willing to work with them, or in other cases, more resistant, or how is that playing out?
Well, like I said, some have just flat out said no to renegotiating, but there are some places where school boards or other education boards are led by people who are not fans of the right to work law, that effort, how it was done, and so they're you know, going along with it. But that doesn't mean that they're not asking for things in return. And you know, I'm not just a guest here. I am also a constituent. I'm a proud Post Oak parent.
great stuff.
But I'm wondering, are we going to, you know, maybe see if we're doing some long-term changes, you know, some really big-picture thinking, year-round classes, things like that. Are those part of the discussions?
Well, you know, we have talked about it on and off, but I think we have entered into a reconfiguration program last year, okay? So that needs to be reviewed and see where we go from the first year, see what happened, what needs to be done differently, and that is not out of the question, by the way. But we need to see where we're at this point.
Will you ask for additional school closings?
Well, it depends on our student count. Remember, we did consolidate the different groupings like pre-K 3 and 4-6. I think those schools are pretty much on target at this point. We'll see what happens next year. I haven't heard about it in terms of needing to close a school or schools. But, you know, those are things that come as we look at our both our budget and our student count.
Mm-hmm. But, of course, school districts, if they want to ask for, you know, concessions in exchange for these really, you know, drawn-out contracts, I mean, you know, the window is, you know, roughly a month, actually a little less than that, because they have to submit the contract. So this is, if you're going to ask for big stuff, this is the moment.
Well, you know, we met and we looked at the district's needs, and for now and for the future, and we have given the administration, you know, the green light to go ahead and meet with the teachers, bargain, if you will, in good faith, but knowing that we need certain things.
Right. Continue. Continue.
No, knowing that we need certain things that we need to be comfortable with what we need, and hopefully that the teachers union would also, you know, look at that way, because we're not necessarily anti-unionist, but we know that our first priority is the good health of the district, and that is our goal.
Some supporters of right to work are saying that locking in contracts quickly ends up denying union members the right to opt out of what is now a perfectly legal choice. Are people talking about that, Rick Pluta?
And that would be the I think that would be the basis of any legal challenge, which is that this is a separate agreement. It actually stretches out a lot further than the typical labor bargain between a school district and the teachers and other school employees, and you know, it would be sort of an obvious effort to get around a statute enacted by the legislature.
But they have to be approved by the union itself too. So if teachers are not willing to stay, you know, the same, they can vote against it.
And that's a really great point, because you know, while the unions, primarily the Michigan Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, but there are other unions that represent some school employees, that, you know, they may be willing to give up things in order to, you know, maintain the agency shop, but they can't give away so much that their members will say, I can't agree to that.
Right.
Guillermo, you've been around teachers a long time. You've been on the school board for a long time. When whatever contract that's in effect on March 27th finally expires, whether it's 2016 or 2018, right, whenever that is, even if it's years down the road, do you have any feel for how many teachers will opt out of dues paying? Do you have any feel for that?
Well, I guess if you look at how the contracts have been ratified by the teachers union, obviously you have majority, but sometimes it's been not an overwhelming majority, but majority nevertheless. So I don't know. Given that, some teachers may opt not to do it. I really don't have a feel for that. You know, the teachers go there to teach, but they do, and they, not all teachers are talking to us necessarily or conversing, but some teachers have traditionally or on and off not supported the contract.
Are you running into that, Rick? I mean, any discussion of years down the road, how many union members will end up opt out of doing
that? We don't know. We know what's happened in other states, and it could be a quarter to a third, which would be, you know, a huge bite out of you know, the union's finances, bargaining clout, and whatnot.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, that's why they're so anxious to. If this were just going to be a matter of a couple of members dropping off, we wouldn't be seeing this kind of fighting maneuvering. Stakes are big.
Do you expect the unions to more vigorously promote the advantages of union membership in the next few years?
They have to.
Yeah.
They have to.
I would think they would. Guillermo Lopez, anything to say about that?
Well, I mean, you know, that the union certainly wants to continue with their program, and they're going to have to, again, sell the program to their membership. And all that I can say as a school board member, and I think I speak for the rest, is that we have our goals set. We have our needs to identify for now and into the future. So we need the teachers to help us accomplish that for the benefit of the kids in the school district.
You know, there's a...
Continue, Rick. Quickly, though, please.
Yeah, there's another aspect of this that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. You know, we've talked about the ability to collect dues and fees, but also there is codicils in these contracts that make the teachers' union the sole bargaining agent for teachers in that district. And one of the things that, that this would extend is that, as opposed to a situation where you could literally have two unions, three unions, four unions in a district, all competing for membership, all competing for the right to bargain for teachers.
Well, we already have nine groups in our district, so, I mean, to have more is...
You could have more.
Guillermo Lopez is president of the Lansing School Board. Rick Pluta is a reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Thank you, guys.
Good to see you here. Bye, Rick.
Bye, Gamer.
Its current state on WKAR, the record low water levels in the Great Lakes are rightly receiving a lot of attention right now. In fact, we had a conversation about the low levels last week here on the show. But evidence is growing that Michigan's groundwater resources are quietly becoming a concern for the long-term future. Robert Glennon is the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of Arizona, and he's the author of the 2009 book Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. Robert knows Michigan well, having taught at Wayne State University's law school for 12 years, and he joins us by phone from Arizona. Welcome to the program, Robert Glennon.
Good morning, Mark, and hello to all my friends in Michigan.
All righty. You maintain that it's not just Great Lakes water levels we should be concerned about. How so?
The truth is that groundwater pumping is exploding in Michigan and around the country. State has made an effort through its water use program to at least understand the sizable diversions and pumping that is occurring, but the rules are still very permissive on who can drill a new well. And what's really driving it, I think, Mark, are two things. One, that the 2012 drought is so severe that farmers in particular are desperate for new sources of water, and they've turned often to groundwater for that need. And second, the price of corn is at an all-time record. And when you have corn at between $7 and $8 a bushel, boy, it changes the equation.
Well, it's an incentive to grow more corn, and in a dry situation, then you need more water. Is that the connection?
Both. Even if it weren't historically low drought, what farmers in the Midwest and the East are discovering is what farmers in the West have known for a while, which is if you can add a little more water to what Mother Nature provides, you can get a significant bump up in crop yields. And the problem for Michigan is that often these wells, and there are thousands of them, in fact, Michigan has more wells, more private wells than any other state, are located close to sensitive water courses, small springs, rivers, creeks, wetlands. And there's an intimate connection between the water in the ground and the water on top of the ground.
What about the connection to the Great Lakes? Is there some kind of connection there, or are we really talking two different sources of water?
Well, the Great Lakes are an enormous body, of course, but they're very fragile. Only 1% of the Great Lakes is renewed by precipitation, by surface water runoff, and by groundwater recharge. So it doesn't take too much to harm them. And in the last 3 years, Michigan has permitted more than 1,100 high-capacity wells. Each of them is capable of pumping more than 100,000 gallons of water per day. So when you multiply that out, it's a lot of water.
Now, you maintain fracking is also playing a part in this. How is that?
Well, fracking is, the jury's sort of out on fracking. Fracking has been around for a long time, but what's now happening is that there's such a groundswell of new wells being drilled, new fracking wells, and each well takes several million gallons of water, and you start to multiply those out and you have the same sort of problem. I mean, I think conceptually, Mark, the important thing for all of us to understand is that groundwater is finite. We should think of an aquifer as a giant milkshake glass, and each well as a straw in the glass. And what Michigan and most states allow is a very large or even unlimited number of straws in the glass.
That's a great image. Now, usage has climbed, Robert Glennon, but some percentage of what's used must go back into aquifers. Is this a case for better water recycling as well?
Well, recycling is a hugely important part of the solution, especially for the urban sector. In the ag sector, there will be some water that's supplied by sprinkler systems to the land. A lot of it is used by the plant. Some of it evaporates up into the air. Some of it percolates back into the groundwater system. So it is, some of it is replenished.
But is a lot being wasted as well?
Well, I wouldn't say it's wasted. It's just being used. And when you have more pumping out of the aquifer than Mother Nature recharges each year, then the water table drops. So it's an unsustainable use of a finite resource.
Okay. Michigan apparently has a water withdrawal law. What is its place in this discussion?
Oh, it's terrific. It's one of the great programs that the state has implemented. And the first thing it does is it lets you know what's being done. In all too many places, there's not good data. And as the old adage goes, Mark, you can't manage what you don't measure. So the water use program puts in place an insistence that people report what they're doing. And it places limits on new diversions or pumping that would have particularly adverse consequences. But the fact remains, as I said, there's still more than 1,000 new high-capacity wells that have been drilled even under the water use programs.
We have about 45 seconds. What's on your short list of remedies for this situation?
Well, we talked about water reuse. We talked about conservation. One of the ones that I'd just like to plant the seed about is price signals. We Americans are spoiled. We wake up in the morning and we turn on the tap and out comes as much fresh water as we want for less than we pay for cell phone service or for cable television. And if you think about that for a couple of moments, you realize that we don't have the price signals right for protecting this precious resource.
Robert Glennon is the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. He's the author of the 2009 book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. Robert Glennon, thank you for discussing Michigan's groundwater with us today.
It was a pleasure to be with you, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, how big a home court advantage does the Izzone give Michigan State tonight against number one Indiana? Also, what's new at the Broad Art Museum in East Lansing? Already there are new things. Stay close for Michael Rush. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. I want to congratulate a pair of great Spartans, Steve Smith, a standout here in East Lansing, and in the NBA for many years. And Mateen Cleaves, Stephen Mateen, and six other native Michiganians were inducted into the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame in Detroit yesterday. Also inducted Tony Dungy, Dave Bing, Al Kaline. It took till 2013 to induct Al Kaline into the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame. And Dave Bing, for that matter, too. Anyway, congratulations to all. Now that it's been open for a few months, it's time for the Broad Art Museum at Michigan State University to change things up. Some inaugural exhibits are departing, and three new exhibits go on display this Friday. WKAR Scott Pohl talked with the museum's curator of contemporary art, Allison Gass, about what's new at the Broad.
We have three exhibitions. They are Aniza Khan, a solo exhibition of a young Pakistani female artist who's never had a museum show in the United States before, which is really exciting. That's organized for us by Karin Zitzowitz, who's a professor in the art history department at MSU. And then we're opening an exhibition called Cuica Diarios by the artist Guillermo Cuica, who's Argentinian. And this is an exhibition organized by the Drawing Center in New York, coming to us on loan. And finally, a small collections show organized by me called Geometries, Selections from the Collection, which looks at the role of geometry in 20th century abstraction. And we'll, in the end, partner with our next big show that opens in March, an exhibition I've curated called Pattern Follow the Rule. So those will kind of go together once we get the whole museum changed over.
Describe them for me, please.
There are three very different exhibitions. The Aniza Khan exhibition is really a study of contemporary conditions in Pakistan, particularly in Karachi. It will be a combination of things in that gallery. There are extraordinary metal sculptures that she makes, which are called armor lingerie. They're amazing, almost sort of bustiers made of steel, and those will hang in part from the ceiling. In other instances, they'll sit on pedestals. There are large, beautiful, colorful paintings that are kind of these lilting visions of life in Pakistan, a series of photographs, and two video projections. So that show will really cover a great deal, and it's a beautiful, thoughtful, scholarly show, again, curated by a professor here. Cuica Diarios is a very simple idea and a very powerful show. There are 17 paintings in the exhibition. They are all 48-inch round canvases. They're called diarios because they're really kind of diaries. Each one of them was made in a single day by Guillermo Cuica, and they really are kind of a combination of writing and painting and drawing and mapping and really thinking about imagination, memory, and sort of the self on a daily basis, putting things out on canvas in this instance. So you'll see those installed around the gallery along with a large video that's an image of Cuica actually making the work. So there's kind of a didactic element there. And Geometries looks at great work from our collection. We have 10 series of Joseph Albers prints, The Homage to the Square, which kind of explores depth as colors change across a set pattern. A beautiful, our major Ken Nolan color field painting, which is just an amazing thing to see in person, one of my favorite pieces from the collection. Six prints from Sala Witt, looking at the way depth changes as lines are added and subtracted from the same format. Two Bridget Rileys that really play with kind of optical illusion and seem to undulate when you look at them. And the two Kristen Kammermeyers that we acquired out of our summer show last year. So kind of taking us from the first part of the 20th century to work being made literally, you know, in this year by Kristen. So that's a great show, too. So there's a wide range of things that you can see when you come to the museum right now.
Which exhibits are we losing here?
We've just closed In Search of Time, which was curated by our director, Michael Rush, and that was his exhibition that looked at cross-historical dialogues through the collection and some key Broad Foundation loans. So that's gone now, and we're sad to say goodbye to it. But and then we will, on February 24th is the last day to see the major installations that you've come to know, the Inigo Manglano Ovale, the Petroj Soweto House, the Chenchu Lins or the Hanging in Space, those will close, and then Michael Rush's Global Groove show will close as well.
Allison Gass is curator of contemporary art at the Broad Art Museum at Michigan State University. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Scott. It was fun.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And here to talk with us some more about the museum's first few months and what is next, founding director Michael Rush. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, Mark. Thanks.
Are you and the staff eager to shake things up a little bit?
Well, we're always eager to shake things up. But, you know, it's funny, in the museum business, for those of us who curate shows and direct shows, whatever, it's always a mixed thing to see one of your babies sort of leave the museum and make way for the new. And for me, it's been a real privilege to be able to curate the opening exhibitions of the new Broad at MSU. So it's a bit of a mixed feeling, actually.
Yeah. You've not been open 3 months. Will this be about the standard amount of time on a regular basis?
Yes.
When you make changes?
Yeah. The idea is that we never want to close in order to turn exhibitions over. We will always be open, so there will always be some galleries that people can see exciting work in. But every few months, yes, certain shows will start to come down and other shows will come up.
The larger public's just become aware of a lot of these works, but you've been looking at them a lot longer, obviously.
We have, yes. The our curator, Allie, whom you just heard, you know, she's always got her eyes open, and she's always traveling and looking at galleries and speaking with artists. But what's particularly interesting and exciting about the shows that are coming down and those that are coming up, is the fact that these exhibitions represent a real international reach. You heard Ali talking about an artist from Argentina, an artist from Pakistan. In some of the exhibits coming down, we have artists from Iran and Palestine, Japan, Korea. Our mission to present the finest in international cultural production and art is really being lived. So we're bringing the world to East Lansing in a way that's very unique, very exciting, and people are responding.
What works that are at the Broad right now have you gotten the most feedback on?
Well, you know, the video in the on the ground floor, the 3D video about the evolution of the world,
yeah,
has been enormously popular. I mean, that artist, Marco Brambilla, who was from L.A. but now is based in New York, he took film clips from hundreds of Hollywood movies and created his own version of the evolution of humankind. And he presents it in 3D. It's really mesmerizing. It's only 3 minutes long, which is perfect for our ADD world, for people to come and just get a 3-minute hit on something that's really magnificent. I think other videos upstairs, people love to see what people are doing around the world. There's some very simple touches of artists, you know, filming their fathers or filming mysterious scenes in Berlin. I mean, there's that beautiful salt sculpture of a boat that's 2 tons of salt. I mean, I could go on and on, but I think people are responding to the very personal and very smart touches that these artists from all around the world are bringing to our museum.
Has attendance been what you'd hoped or expected?
You know, Mark, it's so amazing. Attendance has been so far beyond our expectations. You know, as a museum director, we're always trying to put a positive spin on things, but I don't have to put a positive spin on things more than the reality is. The attendance has so far surpassed our expectations. We are reaching today, this weekend anyway, 45,000 people in the first few months. And that's it averages, you know, at least 2,500, 3,000 people a week. We were hoping to do, we would consider ourselves doing really well if we had 100,000 people during our first year. I mean, we'll probably double that at the rate we're going, if not more so.
Do you know where your visitors are coming from?
Yes, we're taking, you know, we don't have something as systematic as I would like as yet about tracking our visitors. What we're doing is taking zip codes of people as they come in. Now, I can tell you that about 65% are from zip codes within the 30-mile radius of the museum. But the rest are people from around the country and from different parts of the world, actually. Several people, you know, who come to MSU for whatever reason, either they're visiting faculty or they're visiting for a symposium or they're family members. They're all coming through the museum, so we're tracking them as well. So we're getting, like any museum, largely people from relatively close by, but we're also getting a good mix of people from all around. We're really thrilled about it.
Talk to us about the response of the artistic community itself. Does that carry more weight with you? What resonates with you about the feedback you're getting from people with a particular interest in art?
Well, there's the artistic community that's here, and I know, speaking to many artists, how thrilled they are to have, you know, the best art in the world, in the contemporary world, coming here so they can see it. You know, this is one of our goals here, to really elevate the conversation about art here. I firmly believe that the Greater Lansing area can be a very significant artistic community, even more than it is now, by virtue of the fact of the really excellent art department that's at Michigan State University, now by virtue of the museum being present, a world-class museum. And also, the other ingredient is housing and studio space. There's affordable housing around here and studio space for artists. This combination is really a perfect formula for an artistic community. On the larger scale, artists from around the world are eager to show here. We're right now negotiating new films with an artist from Iran. We have, as Ali was saying, an artist from Pakistan. She's arriving today. We've hired a curator from Beijing who was just with us this week. He, by the way, has just been chosen by China to curate the Chinese pavilion at the Venice Biennale, which is an extraordinary honor. So we've got artists and curators from around the world really wanting to join us. We have these collaborations with museums in China and Istanbul and Sao Paulo. So we're really on a roll, and we hope to rock and roll into the future.
What's the most flattered you've been by any feedback that you've received so far?
Well, you know, for me, going through the museum and seeing families and seeing their children either sitting on the floor in front of a painting or asking one of the guides or asking me, you know, what is that? It's so much fun. Can you tell me about it? To see people, particularly people not from the art world, so to say, but people who are just coming to expand their world, to enjoy something new, and seeing them, particularly in clusters of families, and enjoying it and asking questions, there's really nothing more gratifying. People learning something new about their world, and that to think that we at the museum are able to provide that, there's really nothing better.
I will miss Red Factor. I'll tell you that. I was mesmerized
by that. As I'm saying, we've bought Red Factor. Red Factor is entering the permanent collection. Red Factor, it's this balloon-like takeoff on a Buckminster Fuller geodesic dome. It looks like a projectile that's about to fly through the front windows of the museum. It is great, but you know, the reason it's called Red Factor is because that little red bird that's on the suspension wire there is a type of canary that is threatened with extinction. So, as with so many artists nowadays, they're creating works of beauty, of interest, but also works that have a social impact, that make us think. And that's certainly true of the artists that are forthcoming. Naizah Khan from Pakistan is really making us think. I mean, on the news this morning is another bombing in Pakistan, and, you know, our visitors are going to be brought very up close and personal, so to say, to the situation in Pakistan through this artist's work. And the artist Guillermo Cuitca from Argentina will also be showing us very closely his personal response to daily life, his own artistic life. We're going to be actually watching an artist at during his very process. These paintings that you're going to see are reflections of the artist at work. So we're going to be able to look into his mind, into his imagination, as he sits in his studio in Argentina creating artwork.
Are people who may have found the architecture, the exterior of the building, a little difficult to get used to? Mm. Are they warming up to that?
Well, I think so, Mark. And I think, you know, mostly what I hear, maybe people don't give the criticisms to me, I'm not sure. But I think the thing that I hear mostly from people is how excited they are that this extraordinary piece of contemporary architecture is in their community, and they feel enormous pride. It's that word pride that keeps coming up to me from people in the community, people at the university. They're just so proud that something like this exists in their hometown, in the place where they live. And as they say it's a place that they can bring their friends. It's, they say finally there's some place that they can bring people that they feel enormously proud of. So I'm sure there are people who feel that, you know, this rather unusual spaceship doesn't belong on Grand River, but I really haven't heard it, quite honestly. I heard things like that in anticipation of the building, but now that we're open and people are seeing lines around the block and businesses across the street are booming, at least in part because of us. I'm sure you heard the story that one of the coffee shops had to close down opening weekend because business was so brisk they ran out of product. So it's, I think by and large, really the response is one of enormous pleasure and pride, as I say.
As founding director, I have to ask you, was there, did you have a model museum? Did you have another museum in your head that you referred back to any extent as a model for this? Or did you really want to be groundbreaking with this and not rely on a model?
Well, you know, I've navigated the museum world for several years now, so it's sort of in my blood. And there are several museums. There's a couple of museums in Germany. There's the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. I mean, what I've wanted and what MSU seems to want very clearly is for us to be the international cultural link in this very global reach that MSU has, really honestly, from around the world. So we're trying to situate ourselves as the leading international contemporary university contemporary art museum in the country, and I think we will do that. Very few places have such a strong international focus as we do. I mean, we're really going for broke on this international presentation aspect of what we're doing. So, yes, I mean, having traveled and knowing what some other museums do that are really impressive, yes, I think we're trying to bring the best of practices from around the world to here, but I also think we're doing it in a way that's particular to our locale and particular to Michigan State University. The other night, for example, in conjunction with one of our installations, we had Professor Joan Rose from the Department of Water Supply talking about international water issues, access to water. We even showed a YouTube piece from Matt Damon, who has an organization devoted to water access. We played that for folks. And it was quite really a mesmerizing evening for people to discuss a huge world issue within the context of an art installation. It was tremendously lively, and we're going to be doing this all the time.
Michael Rush is the founding director of East Lansing's Broad Art Museum, talking about what's new at the Broad. You'll see it starting this weekend. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Well, just when Spartan fans thought the excitement of beating in-state rival Michigan couldn't be topped, along comes what's shaping up to be the match of the season. Number 4 MSU hosts number 1 Indiana tonight at the Breslin Center, and dominance of the Big Ten hangs in the balance. MSU's victory over Michigan last week was due in part to a rocking home crowd. Some said it was the loudest they'd heard the Breslin Center in a long time, and the place should be roaring again tonight, thanks in large part to the student frenzy that is the Izzone. And current state's Kevin Lavery checks out what gives MSU such a home court advantage.
Maybe it was the big asteroid that narrowly missed the Earth last Friday, or perhaps the smaller one that almost pulverized Russia just hours before. The world of college hoops is witnessing a cosmic alignment as two bright shooting stars will blaze through East Lansing tonight to fight for sole dominance of the Big Ten. Michigan State University and Indiana. Each team is 11-2. The Associated Press ranks the Hoosiers number 1, with the Spartans eyeing the prize at number 4. And just like Halley's Comet, tonight's matchup is a rarity. It will be the first time two teams ranked in the top 5 will have ever played at the Breslin Center. As MSU head coach Tom Izzo says, it doesn't get any bigger than this. Izzo locking strategic wits with his former assistant Tom Crean, MSU still soaring after a stunning 75-52 victory over archenemy Michigan, which itself had once occupied first place this season. And the icing on the cake? Magic Johnson is coming home to commentate his first ever college game. For Tom Izzo, it's all hands on deck.
We will need everything we can do, plus the crowd that has been so incredible this year, to be at its best. And maybe we can sneak Magic into a uniform if things don't go perfectly well. So it'll. Looking forward to it, excited about it. I think our players are. And this is what college basketball, to me, is all about.
Rebound.
The crowd, Izzo mentioned, is what's famously known around East Lansing as the Izzone. It's the thronging mass of student fans, at its peak 3,000 strong, that girds the Spartans on to nearly the greatness of their ancient warrior namesakes.
Michigan State 75, Michigan 52.
Forward Adrian Payne is ready for the excitement.
The bread's going to be crazy. Everybody know that it's going to be a big game, and it's just that much bigger than, you know, the Michigan game. The fans are going to be crazy. And, you know, it's just the environment going to be, you know, off the chain.
Usually, just before a Spartan game, the student directors who lead the Izzone send out an email reminder to its faithful ranks. But somehow, co-directors Brandon Hines and Corey Prusch don't think that will be necessary this time.
Especially last week and this week for these two games, there's just sort of been this buzz around campus, and everyone's talking about it. Oh, I can't wait for the Michigan game or the Indiana game. And I mean, I've just you can tell the students are excited around here.
I get the impression that being in the Izzone is also about ambassadorship in some way, about presenting a positive image. What's behind that idea, Corey?
Well, we like to think of the Izzone as a classy student section. Tom Izzo has always made that an important fact. We don't want the cursing. We don't want the negativity towards the opposing team. We try to keep that to a minimum. We hire section leaders every year. So this year we have 15 section leaders. So they kind of help. They sit in, you know, the front row of the games. And so if, you know, kids are cursing or chanting inappropriate things, they kind of are there to tell them to keep it down, or, you know, kind of to warn them that that's not what we do. Being in the Izzone, we try to be classy, we try to be positive and keep a good image.
How do you do that? How do you be respectful and sportsmanlike, yet at the same time you're out there trying to nag the other team a little bit?
It's a real fine line between creating that hostile environment but still not crossing the line and going overboard saying things you shouldn't say. I think a lot of it is just students just learn from the moment they come into the Izzone that the Izzone is a nationally recognized student section. It's always considered one of the best student sections in college basketball. And I think people really take pride in that, and they want to create the most hostile environment, get as rowdy as possible in there without giving the Izzone a bad rep. So
controlled chaos.
Exactly. Controlled chaos. I think it's a great term for it.
Corey, any favorite moments that you can remember from being in the Izzone?
Oh, man, I've been in the Izzone. I'm a senior now. I've been in there every year. But I think this season has just been amazing. You know, last season we had a big rough patch with the Izzone, and this year it's been so fun. I've been, you know, behind the home bench for every game, and just we actually just had some alumni come sit with us in the front row against Michigan, so that was a lot of fun. We had like Austin Thornton and Ayani come out, and Kevin Torbert from it was amazing. I think that was probably one of my favoriteest moments in the Izzone for sure.
Have you met Magic, guys?
I have not personally, not through the Izzone.
He's going to be actually doing color commentary. The first time in his career he has given commentary during a college game. Any thoughts on that?
I want to go find him. I just want a picture with him. I mean, if you're an Izzone fan, if you're an MSU alumni, you know, basketball fan, like, Magic is the guy. So I hope we can at least meet him one time before I'm out of here.
Corey Prusch and Brandon Hines are co-directors of the Izzone at Michigan State University, and they will be cheering on the Spartans when they take on Indiana University tonight. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Corey.
Thank you, Kevin.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Mobley.
And special thanks to the Spartan Sports Network, who helped in the production of this story. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll visit with a member of Ladysmith Black Mambazo ahead of their performance at the Wharton Center. Neighbors in Action will feature Closing the Digital Gap, which works to provide computers and computer training to low-income adults and families. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and to Sonia Treeweiler and Gabby Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by Liberty Coin Service, now open with a new location in Frandor, offering gold buying and coin collecting services in one combined location for more than 40 years. LibertyCoinService.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.